others among your father's men will have escaped, she said. We must regather them, find...
We will depend upon ourselves, he said. Our immediate concern is our family atomics. We must get them before the Harkonnens can search them out.
Not likely they'll be found, she said, the way they were hidden.
It must not be left to chance.
And she thought, blackmail with the family atomics as a threat to the planet and its spice. That's what he has in mind. But all he can hope for then is escape into renegade anonymity.
His mother's words had provoked another train of thought in Paul, a duke's concern for all the people they'd lost this night. People are the true strength of a great house, Paul thought, and he remembered Howitt's words.
Parting with people is a sadness. A place is only a place.
They're using Sardaukar, Jessica said. We must wait until the Sardaukar have been withdrawn.
They think us caught between the desert and the Sardaukar, Paul said. They intend that there be no Atreides survivors. Total extermination. Do not count on any of our people escaping.
They cannot go on indefinitely risking exposure of the Emperor's part in this.
Can't they?
Some of our people are bound to escape.
Are they?
Jessica turned away, frightened of the bitter strength in her son's voice, hearing the precise assessment of chances. She sensed that his mind had leaped ahead of her, that it now saw more in some respects than she did. She had helped train the intelligence which did this, but now she found herself fearful of it. Her thoughts turned, seeking toward the lost sanctuary of her duke, and tears burned her eyes.
This is the way it had to be, Leto, she thought. A time of love and a time of grief.
She rested her hand on her abdomen, awareness focused on the embryo there.
I have the Atreides' daughter I was ordered to produce, but the Reverend Mother was wrong. A daughter wouldn't have saved my Leto. This child is only life reaching for the future in the midst of death. I conceived out of instinct and not out of obedience.
Try the Communinet receiver again, Paul said.
The mind goes on working no matter how we try to hold it back, she thought.
Jessica found the tiny receiver Idaho had left for them, flipped its switch. A green light glowed on the instrument's face. Tinny screeching came from its speaker. She reduced the volume, hunted across the bands. A voice speaking Atreides battle language came into the tent.
Back and regroup at the ridge. Fedor reports no survivors in Carthag, and the Guild Bank has been sacked.
Carthag, Jessica thought. That was a Harkonnen hotbed.
There's Sardaukar, the voice said. Watch out for Sardaukar in Atreides uniforms. There...
A roaring filled the speaker, then silence.
Try the other bands, Paul said.
Do you realize what that means? Jessica asked.
I expected it. They want the Guild to blame us for destruction of their bank. With the Guild against us, we're trapped on Arrakis. Try the other bands.
She weighed his words. I expected it. What had happened to him?
Slowly, Jessica returned to the instrument. As she moved the band slide, they caught glimpses of violence in the few voices calling out in Atreides battle language.
Fall back! Try to regroup at... Trapped in a cave at...
And there was no mistaking the victorious exultation in the Harkonnen gibberish that poured from the other bands. Sharp commands, battle reports. There wasn't enough of it for Jessica to register and break the language, but the tone was obvious. Harkonnen victory. Paul shook the pack beside him, hearing the two little jons of water gurgle there. He took a deep breath, looked up through the transparent end of the tent at the rock escarpment outlined against the stars. His left hand felt the sphincter seal of the tent's entrance.
It'll be dawn soon, he said. We can wait through the day for Idaho, but not through another night. In the desert, you must travel by night and rest in shade through the day.
Remembered lore insinuated itself into Jessica's mind.
Without a stillsuit, a man sitting in shade on the desert needs 5 liters of water a day to maintain body weight.
She felt the slick, soft skin of the stillsuit against her body, thinking how their lives depended on these garments.
If we leave here, Idaho can't find us, she said.
There are ways to make any man talk, he said. If Idaho hasn't returned by dawn, we must consider the possibility he has been captured. How long do you think he could hold out?
The question required no answer, and she sat in silence. Paul lifted the seal on the pack, pulled out a tiny micromanual with glow tab and magnifier. Green and orange letters leaped up at him from the pages.
Litterjohns, still tent, energy caps, recaths, sand snork, binoculars,
stillsuit rep kit, Baradai pistol, sink chart, felt plugs, paracompass, maker hooks, thumpers, frem kit, fire pillar. So many things for survival on the desert. Presently, he put the manual aside on the tent floor.
"Where can we possibly go?" Jessica asked.
"My father spoke of desert power," Paul said. "The Harkonnens cannot rule this planet without it. They have never ruled this planet, nor shall they. Not even with 10,000 legions of Sardaukar."
"Paul, you can't think that we've all the evidence in our hands," he said.
"Right here in this tent. The tent itself, this pack and its contents, these still suits. We know the Guild wants a prohibitive price for weather satellites. We know that..."
"What have weather satellites to do with it?" she asked. "They couldn't possibly..."
She broke off. Paul sensed the hyper-alertness of his mind reading her reactions, computing on minutiae. "You see it now," he said. "Satellites watch the terrain below. There are things in the deep desert that will not bear frequent inspection."
"You're suggesting the Guild itself controls this planet?"
She was so slow.
"No," he said. "The Fremen. They're paying the Guild for privacy. Paying in a coin that's freely available to anyone with desert power. Spice. This is more than a second approximation answer. It's the straight-line computation. Depend on it."
"Paul," Jessica said, "you're not a Mentat yet. You can't know for sure how..."
"I'll never be a Mentat," he said. "I'm something else. A freak."
"Paul, how can you say such..."
"Leave me alone."
He turned away from her, looking out into the night.
"Why can't I mourn?" he wondered.
He felt that every fiber of his being craved this release, but it would be denied him forever. Jessica had never heard such distress in her son's voice. She wanted to reach out to him, hold him, comfort him, help him. But she sensed there was nothing she could do. He had to solve this problem by himself. The glowing tab of the Fremkit manual between them on the tent floor caught her eye. She lifted it, glanced at the flyleaf, reading,
"Manual of the Friendly Desert, the place full of life. Here are the Ayat and Burhan of life. Believe, and Allah shall never burn you."
It reads like the Ajar book, she thought, recalling her studies of the great secrets.
Has a manipulator of religions been on Arrakis?
Paul lifted the paracompass from the pack, returned it, said, "Think of all these special application Fremen machines. They show unrivaled sophistication. Admit it. The culture that made these things betrays depths no one suspected." Hesitating, still worried by the harshness in his voice, Jessica returned to the book, studied an illustrated constellation from the Arakeen sky, Muad'Dib, the mouse, and noted that the tail pointed north. Paul stared into the tent's darkness at the dimly discerned movements of his mother revealed by the manual's glow tab. "Now is the time to carry out my father's wish," he thought. "I must give her his message now, while she has time for grief. Grief would inconvenience us later." And he found himself shocked by precise logic. "Mother," he said.
"Yes?"
She heard the change in his voice, felt coldness in her entrails at the sound. Never had she heard such harsh control.
"My father is dead," he said.
She searched within herself for the coupling of fact and fact and fact, the Bene Gesserit way of assessing data, and it came to her, the sensation of terrifying loss. Jessica nodded, unable to speak.
"My father charged me once," Paul said, "to give you a message if anything happened to him. He feared you might believe he distrusted you."
"That useless suspicion," she thought.
"He wanted you to know he never suspected you," Paul said, and explained the deception, adding, "He wanted you to know he always trusted you completely, always loved you and cherished you. He said he would sooner have mistrusted himself, and he had but one regret, that he never made you his duchess."
She brushed the tears coursing down her cheeks, thought,
"What a stupid waste of the body's water!"
But she knew this thought for what it was, the attempt to retreat from grief into anger.
"Leto, my Leto," she thought, "what terrible things we do to those we love!"
With a violent motion, she extinguished the little manual's glow tab. Sobs shook her. Paul heard his mother's grief and felt the emptiness within himself.
"I have no grief," he thought. "Why? Why?"
He felt the inability to grieve as a terrible flaw.
"A time to get and time to lose," Jessica thought, quoting to herself from the O.C. Bible. a time to keep and a time to cast away, a time for love and a time to hate, a time of war and a time of peace.
Paul's mind had gone on in its chilling precision. He saw the avenues ahead of them on this hostile planet. Without even the safety valve of dreaming, he focused his prescient awareness, seeing it as a computation of most probable futures, but with something more, an edge of mystery, as though his mind dipped into some timeless stratum and sampled the winds of the future. Abruptly, as though he had found a necessary key, Paul's mind climbed another notch in awareness. He felt himself clinging to this new level, clutching at a precarious hold and peering about. It was as though he existed within a globe with avenues radiating away in all directions, yet this only approximated the sensation. He remembered once seeing a gauze kerchief blowing in the wind, and now he sensed the future as though it twisted across some surface as undulant and impermanent as that of the wind-blown kerchief. He saw people. He felt the heat and cold of uncounted probabilities. He knew names and places, experienced emotions without number, reviewed data of innumerable unexplored crannies. There was time to probe and test and taste, but no time to shape. The thing was a spectrum of possibilities from the most remote past to the most remote future, from the most probable to the most improbable. He saw his own death in countless ways. He saw new planets, new cultures. People. People. He saw them in such swarms they could not be listed, yet his mind catalogued them. Even the guildsmen. And he thought, the guild, there'd be a way for us. My strangeness accepted as a familiar thing of high value, always with an assured supply of the now necessary spice. But the idea of living out his life in the mind groping ahead through possible futures that guided hurtling spaceships appalled him. It was a way, though, and in meeting the possible future that contained guildsmen, he recognized his own strangeness.
I have another kind of sight. I see another kind of terrain, the available paths.
The awareness conveyed both reassurance and alarm. So many places on that other kind of terrain dipped or turned out of his sight. As swiftly as it had come, the sensation slipped away from him, and he realized the entire experience had taken the space of a heartbeat. Yet his own personal awareness had been turned over, illuminated in a terrifying way. He stared around him. Night still covered the still tent within its rock-enclosed hideaway. His mother's grief could still be heard. His own lack of grief could still be felt, that hollow place somewhere separated from his mind, which went on in its steady pace, dealing with data, evaluating, computing, submitting answers in something like the Mentat way. And now he saw that he had a wealth of data few such minds ever before had encompassed. But this made the empty place within him no easier to bear. He felt that something must shatter. It was as though a clockwork control for a bomb had been set to ticking within him. It went on about its business, no matter what he wanted. It recorded minuscule shadings of difference around him, a slight change in moisture, a fractional fall in temperature, the progress of an insect across their still tent roof, the solemn approach of dawn in the star-lighted patch of sky he could see out the tent's transparent end. The emptiness was unbearable. Knowing how the clockwork had been set in motion made no difference. He could look to his own past and see the start of it, the training, the sharpening of talents, the refined pressures of sophisticated disciplines, even exposure to the OC Bible at a critical moment, and, lastly, the heavy intake of spice. And he could look ahead, the most terrifying direction, to see where it all pointed.
I'm a monster, he thought, a freak.
No, he said. Then,
no, no, no!
He found that he was pounding the tent floor with his fists. The implacable part of him recorded this as an interesting emotional datum and fed it into computation.